A Canticle for Leibowitz, by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Continued, Cassette 7, Side 2. A pink tongue of dawn was beginning to lick the stars from the sky. Soon he would have to go tell the abbot. And tell him what? Brother Joshua brushed gnats from his beard and started toward the church, because someone had just come to the door and looked out. Looking for him? Unus panis et unum corpus multi sumus, came the murmur from the church. Omnes qui de uno. One bread and one body, though many are we, and of one bread and one chalice have partaken. He paused in the doorway to look back toward the rose bushes. It was a trap, wasn't it? He thought. You'd send it, knowing I'd throw stones at it, wouldn't you? A moment later he slipped inside and went to kneel with the others. His voice joined theirs in the entreaty. For a time he ceased to think, amid the company of monastic spacegoers assembled there. Annunciabatur Domino generatio ventura. And there shall be declared to the Lord a generation to come, and the heaven shall show forth his justice, to a people that shall be born, which the Lord hath made. When he became aware again, he saw the abbot motioning to him. Brother Joshua went to kneel next to him. Hoc officium, fili tibine, imponemus oneri, he whispered. If they want me, the monk answered softly, honorem accipiam. The abbot smiled. You heard me badly. I said burden, not honor. Crucis autem onus si audisti ut honorem nihilo erasti oribus. Accipiam, the monk repeated. You're certain? If they choose me, I shall be certain. Well enough. Thus it was settled. While the sun rose, a shepherd was elected to lead the flock. Afterward, the conventual mass was a mass for pilgrims and travelers. It had not been easy to charter a plane for the flight to New Rome. Even harder was the task of winning clearance for the flight after the plane had been chartered. All civil aircraft had come under the jurisdiction of the military for the duration of the emergency, and a military clearance was required. It had been refused by the local ZDI. If Abbot Zerke had not been aware of the fact that a certain air marshal and a certain cardinal archbishop happened to be friends, the ostensible pilgrimage to New Rome by 27 bookleggers with bindle stiffs might well have proceeded on Shank's mare, for lack of permission to use rapid transport jet. By mid-afternoon, however, clearance had been granted. Abbot Zerke boarded the plane briefly before takeoff, for last farewells. You are the continuity of the order, he told them. With you goes the memorabilia. With you also goes the apostolic succession, and, perhaps, the chair of Peter. No, no, he added in response to the murmur of surprise from the monks, not His Holiness. I had not told you this before, but if the worst comes on earth, the College of Cardinals, or what's left of it, will convene. The Centaurus colony may then be declared a separate patriarchate, with full patriarchal jurisdiction going to the cardinal who will accompany you. If the scourge falls on us here, to him then will go the patrimony of Peter. For though life on earth may be destroyed, God forbid, as long as man lives elsewhere, the office of Peter cannot be destroyed. There are many who think that if the curse falls on earth, the papacy would pass to him by the principle of Epicaea if there were no survivors here. But that is not your direct concern, brothers, sons, although you will be subject to your patriarch under special vows as those which bind the Jesuits to the Pope. You will be years in space. The ship will be your monastery. After the patriarchal see is established at the Centaurus colony, you will establish there a mother house of the Visitationist friars of the Order of St. Leibowitz of Tycho. But the ship will remain in your hands, and the memorabilia. If civilization, or a vestige of it, can maintain itself on Centaurus, you will send missions to the other colony worlds, and perhaps eventually to the colonies of their colonies. Wherever man goes, you and your successors will go, and with you the records and remembrances of 4,000 years and more. Some of you, or those to come after you, will be mendicants and wanderers, teaching the chronicles of earth and the canticles of the crucified, to the peoples and the cultures that may grow out of the colony groups. For some may forget, some may be lost for a time from the faith. Teach them, and receive into the order those among them who are called. Pass on to them the continuity. Be for man the memory of earth and origin. Remember this earth. Never forget her, but never come back. Zerki's voice went hoarse and low. If you ever come back, you might meet the Archangel at the east end of the earth, guarding her passes with a sword of flame. I feel it. Space is your home hereafter. It's a lonelier desert than ours. God bless you, and pray for us. He moved slowly down the aisle, pausing at each seat to bless and embrace before he left the plane. The plane taxied onto the runway and roared aloft. He watched it until it disappeared from view in the evening sky. Afterward, he drove back to the Abbey and to the remainder of his flock. While aboard the plane, he had spoken as if the destiny of Brother Joshua's group were as clear-cut as the prayers prescribed for tomorrow's office. But both he and they knew that he had only been reading the palm of a plan, had been describing a hope and not a certainty. For Brother Joshua's group had only begun the first short lap of a long and doubtful journey, a new exodus from Egypt under the auspices of a god who must surely be very weary of the race of man. Those who stayed behind had the easier part. Theirs was but to wait for the end and pray that it would not come. Chapter 27. The area affected by local fallout remains relatively stationary, said the announcer, and the danger of further wind spread has nearly vanished.
Well, at least nothing worse has happened yet, remarked the abbot's guest. So far we've been from it here. It looks like we'll stay safe unless the conference falls apart.
Will we now? Zerki grunted. But listen a moment. The latest death toll estimate, the announcer continued, on this ninth day after the destruction of the capital, gives 2,800,000 dead. More than half of this figure is from the population of the city proper. The rest is an estimate based on the percentage of the population in the fringe and fallout areas, known to have received critical doses of radiation. Experts predict that the estimate will rise as more radiation cases are reported. This station is required by law to broadcast the following announcement twice daily for the duration of the emergency. The provisions of Public Law 10-WR-3E in no way empower private citizens to administer euthanasia to victims of radiation poisoning. Victims who have been exposed, or who think they have been exposed, to radiation far in excess of the critical dosage, must report to the nearest Green Star Relief Station, where a magistrate is empowered to issue a writ of mori vult to anyone properly certified as a hopeless case, if the sufferer desires euthanasia. Any victim of radiation who takes his own life in any manner other than that prescribed by law will be considered a suicide, and will jeopardize the right of his heirs and dependents to claim insurance and other radiation relief benefits under the law. Moreover, any citizen who assists such a suicide may be prosecuted for murder. The Radiation Disaster Act authorizes euthanasia only after due process of law. Serious cases of radiation sickness must report to a Green Star Relief. Abruptly, and with such force that he twisted the dial knob free of its shaft, Zerki switched off the receiver. He swung himself out of his chair and went to stand at the window and looked down on the courtyard where a crowd of refugees were milling around several hastily built wooden tables. The abbey, old and new, was overrun by people of all ages and stations whose homes had been in the blighted regions. The abbot had temporarily readjusted the cloistered areas of the abbey to give the refugees access to virtually everything except the monks' sleeping quarters. The sign outside the old gate had been removed, for there were women and children to be fed, clothed, and given shelter. He watched two novices carrying a steaming cauldron out of the emergency kitchen. They hoisted it onto a table and began ladling out soup. The abbot's visitor cleared his throat and stirred restlessly in his chair. The abbot turned.
Due process, they call it, he growled. Due process of mass, state-sponsored suicide, with all of society's blessings.
Well, said the visitor, it's certainly better than letting them die horribly by degrees.
Is it? Better for whom? The street cleaners? Better to have your living corpses walk to a central disposal station while they can still walk? Less public spectacle, less horror lying around, less disorder? A few million corpses lying around might start a rebellion against those responsible. That's what you and the government mean by better, isn't it?
I wouldn't know about the government, said the visitor, with only a trace of stiffness in his voice. What I meant by better was more merciful. I have no intention of arguing your mortal theology with you. If you think you have a soul that God would send to hell if you chose to die painlessly instead of horribly, then go ahead and think so. But you're in a minority, you know. I disagree, but there's nothing to argue about.
Forgive me, said Abbot Zerke. I wasn't getting ready to argue moral theology with you. I was speaking only of this spectacle of mass euthanasia in terms of human motivation. The very existence of the Radiation Disaster Act, and like laws in other countries, is the plainest possible evidence that governments were fully aware of the consequences of another war. But instead of trying to make the crime impossible, they tried to provide in advance for the consequences of the crime. Are the implications of that fact meaningless to you, Doctor?
Of course not, Father. Personally, I'm a pacifist. But for the present, we are stuck with the world as it is. And if they couldn't agree on a way to make an act of war impossible, then it is better to have some provisions for coping with the consequences than to have no provisions.
Yes and no. Yes, if it's in anticipation of somebody else's crime. No, if it's in anticipation of one's own. And especially no, if the provision to soften the consequences are criminal, too. The visitor shrugged.
Like euthanasia? I'm sorry, Father. I feel that the laws of society are what makes something a crime or not a crime. I'm aware that you don't agree, and there can be bad laws, ill-conceived, true. But in this case, I think we have a good law. If I thought I had such a thing as a soul, and that there was an angry God in heaven, I might agree with you.
Abbot Zerke smiled thinly. You don't have a soul, Doctor. You are a soul. You have a body, temporarily. The visitor laughed politely.
A semantic confusion.
True, but which of us is confused? Are you sure?
Let's not quarrel, Father. I'm not with the Mercy Cadre. I work on the Exposure Survey Team. We don't kill anybody.
Abbot Zerke gazed at him in silence for a moment. The visitor was a short, muscular man with a pleasant round face and a balding pate that was sunburned and freckled. He wore a green serge uniform, and a cap with the green star insignia lay in his lap. Why quarrel, indeed? The man was a medical worker, not an executioner. Some of the Green Star's relief work was admirable. Occasionally, it was even heroic. That in some instances it wrought evil, according to Zerke's belief, was no reason to regard its good works as tainted. The bulk of society favored it, and its workers were in good faith. The doctor had tried to be friendly. His request had seemed simple enough. He had been neither demanding nor officious about it. Still, the abbot hesitated before saying yes.
The work you want to do here, will it take long?
The doctor shook his head.
2 days at most, I think. We have 2 mobile units. We can bring them into your courtyard, hitch the 2 trailers together, and start right to work. We'll take the obvious radiation cases and the wounded first. We treat only the most urgent cases. Our job is clinical testing. The sick ones will get treatment at an emergency camp.
And the sickest ones get something else at a mercy camp?
The worker frowned. Only if they want to go, nobody makes them go.
But you write out the permit that lets them go.
I've given some red tickets, yes. I may have to this time. Here.
He fumbled in his jacket pocket and brought out a red cardboard form, something like a shipping label with a loop of wire for attaching it to a buttonhole or a belt loop. He tossed it on the desk.
A blank crit dose form. That it is. Read it.
It tells the man he's sick, very sick. And here's a green ticket, too. It tells him he's well and has nothing to worry about. Look at the red one carefully. Estimated exposure in radiation units. Blood count. Your analysis. On one side, it's just like the green one. On the other side, the green one's blank. But look at the back of the red one. The fine print. It's directly quoted from Public Law 10-WR-3E. It has to be there. The law requires it. It has to be read to him. He has to be told his rights. What he does about it is his own affair. Now, if you'd rather we park the mobile units down the highway, we can...
You just read it to him, do you? Nothing else?
The doctor paused. It has to be explained to him if he doesn't understand it. He paused again, gathering irritation.
Good Lord, Father, when you tell a man he's a hopeless case, what are you going to say? Read him a few paragraphs of the law, show him the door, and say, next, please? You're going to die, so good day? Of course you don't read him that and nothing else, not if you have any human feeling at all.
I understand that. What I want to know is something else. Do you, as a physician, advise hopeless cases to go to a mercy camp?
The medic stopped and closed his eyes. He rested his forehead on his hand. He shuddered slightly.
Of course I do, he said finally. If you'd seen what I've seen, you would too. Of course I do.
You'll not do it here.
Then we'll...
The doctor quenched an angry outburst. He stood up, started to put on his cap, then paused. He tossed the cap on the chair and walked over to the window. He looked gloomily down at the courtyard, then out at the highway. He pointed.
There's the roadside park. We can set up shop there. But it's 2 miles. Most of them will have to walk.
He glanced at Abbot Zerke, then looked broodingly down into the courtyard again.
Look at them. They are sick, hurt, fractured, frightened. The children, too. Tired, lame, and miserable. You'd let them be herded off down the highway to sit in the dust and the sun and...
I don't want it to be that way, said the abbot. Look, you were just telling me how a man-made law made it mandatory for you to read and explain this to a critical radiation case. I offered no objection to that in itself. Render unto Caesar to that extent, since the law demands it of you. Can you not then understand that I am subject to another law, and that it forbids me to allow you or anyone else on this property, under my rule, to counsel anyone to do what the church calls evil?
Oh, I understand well enough.
Very well. You need only make me one promise and you may use the courtyard.
What promise?
Simply that you won't advise anyone to go to a mercy camp. Limit yourself to diagnosis. If you find hopeless radiation cases, tell them what the law forces you to tell them. Be as consoling as you wish, but don't tell them to go kill themselves.
The doctor hesitated. I think it would be proper to make such a promise with respect to patients who belong to your faith.
Abbot Zerke lowered his eyes.
I'm sorry, he said finally, but that's not enough.
Why? Others are not bound by your principles. If a man is not of your religion, why should you refuse to allow...
He choked off angrily. Do you want an explanation?
Yes.
Because if a man is ignorant of the fact that something is wrong, and acts in ignorance, he incurs no guilt, provided natural reason was not enough to show him that it was wrong. But while ignorance may excuse the man, it does not excuse the act, which is wrong in itself. If I permitted the act simply because the man is ignorant that it is wrong, then I would incur guilt because I do know it to be wrong. It is really that painfully simple.
Listen, Father, they sit there and they look at you. Some scream, some cry, some just sit there. All of them say, Doctor, what can I do? And what am I supposed to answer? Say nothing? Say, you can die, that's all? What would you say?
Pray.
Yes, you would, wouldn't you? Listen, pain is the only evil I know about. It's the only one I can fight.
Then God help you.
Antibiotics help me more.
Abbot Zerke groped for a sharp reply, found one, but swiftly swallowed it. He searched for a blank piece of paper and a pen, and pushed them across the desk.
Just write, I will not recommend euthanasia to any patient while at this abbey, and sign it. Then you can use the courtyard.
And if I refuse?
Then I suppose they'll have to drag themselves 2 miles down the road.
Of all the merciless...
On the contrary... I've offered you an opportunity to do your work as required by the law you recognize, without overstepping the law I recognize. Whether they go down the road or not is up to you.
The doctor stared at the blank page.
What is so magic about putting it in writing?
I prefer it that way.
He bent silently over the desk and wrote. He looked at what he had written, then slashed his signature under it and straightened.
All right, there's your promise. Do you think it's worth any more than my spoken word?
No, no indeed.
The abbot folded the note and tucked it into his coat.
But it's here in my pocket, and you know it's here in my pocket. And I can look at it occasionally, that's all.
Do you keep promises, by the way, Dr. Coors?
The medic stared at him for a moment.
I'll keep it.
He grunted,
then turned on his heel and stalked out.
"Brother Pat," Abbot Zerke called weakly. "Brother Pat, are you there?"
His secretary came to stand in the doorway.
"Yes, Reverend Father."
"You heard?"
"I heard some of it. The door was open, and I couldn't help hearing. You didn't have the silencer."
"You heard him say it. Pain's the only evil I know about. You heard that?" The monk nodded solemnly.
"And that society is the only thing which determines whether an act is wrong or not? That too?"
"Yes."
"Dearest God, how did those two heresies get back into the world after all this time? Hell has limited imaginations down there. The serpent deceived me and I did eat."
"Brother Pat, you'd better get out of here or I'll start raving."
"Domne, I..."
"What's keeping you? What's that, a letter? All right, give it here." The monk handed it to him and went out. Zerke left it unopened and glanced at the doctor's pledge again. Worthless, perhaps, but still the man was sincere and dedicated. He'd have to be dedicated to work for the kind of salary the Green Star paid. He had looked underslept and overworked. He'd probably been living on Benzedrine and donuts since the shot that killed the city. Seeing misery everywhere and detesting it, and sincere in wanting to do something about it. Sincere, that was the hell of it. From a distance, one's adversaries seemed friends, but with a closer view, one saw the sincerity, and it was as great as one's own. Perhaps Satan was the sincerest of the lot. He opened the letter and read it. The letter informed him that Brother Joshua and the others had departed from New Rome for an unspecified destination in the West. The letter also advised him that information about Quo Peregrinatur had leaked to the ZDI, who had sent investigators to the Vatican to ask questions about the rumored launching of an unauthorized starship. Evidently, the starship was not yet in space. They'd learn soon enough about Quo Peregrinatur, but with the help of heaven, they'd find out too late.
What then? He wondered.
The legal situation was tangled. The law forbade starship departures without commission approval. Approval was hard to get, and slow in coming. Zerke was certain that the ZDI and the commission would consider the church was breaking the law. But a state church concordat had existed for a century and a half now. It clearly exempted the church from licensing procedures, and it guaranteed to the church the right to send missions to whatever space installations and or planetary outposts shall not have been declared by the aforesaid commission to be ecologically critical or closed to unregulated enterprise. Every installation in the solar system was ecologically critical and closed at the time of the Concordat, but the Concordat further asserted the Church's right to own space vessels and travel unrestricted to open installations or outposts. The Concordat was very old. It had been signed in the days when the Bergstrand starship drive was only a dream in the wide imagination of some who thought that interstellar travel would open up the universe to an unrestricted outflow of population. Things had turned out otherwise. When the first starship was born as an engineering drawing, it became plain that no institution except government had the means or the funds to build them, that no profit was to be derived from transporting colonies to extrasolar planets for purposes of interstellar mercantilism. Nevertheless, the Asian rulers had sent the first colony ship. Then in the West, the cry was heard, "Are we to let the inferior races inherit the stars?" There had been a brief flurry of starship launchings, as colonies of black people, brown, white, and yellow people were hurled into the sky toward the Centaur, in the name of racism. Afterwards, geneticists had wryly demonstrated that, since each racial group was so small that unless their descendants intermarried, each would undergo deteriorative genetic drift due to inbreeding on the colony planet. The racists had made crossbreeding necessary to survival. The only interest the Church had taken in space had been concern for the colonists who were sons of the Church, cut off from the flock by interstellar distances. And yet she had not taken advantage of that provision of the Concordat which permitted the sending of missions. Certain contradictions existed between the Concordat and the laws of the state which empowered the commission, at least as the latter law might in theory affect the sending of missions. The contradiction had never been adjudicated by the courts, since there had never been cause for litigation. But now, if the ZDI intercepted Brother Joshua's group in the act of launching a starship without a commission permit or charter, there would be cause. Zerke prayed that the group would get away without a test in the courts, which might take weeks or months. Of course there would be a scandal afterwards. Many would charge not only that the church had violated commission rulings, but charity, too, by sending ecclesiastical dignitaries and a bunch of rascal monks, when she might have used the ship as refuge for poor colonists hungry for land. The conflict of Martha and Mary always recurred. Abbot Zerke suddenly realized that the tenor of his thinking had changed during the previous day or two. A few days ago, everyone had been waiting for the sky to burst asunder. But 9 days had passed since Lucifer had prevailed in space and scorched a city out of existence. Despite the dead, the maimed, and the dying, there had been 9 days of silence. Since the wrath had been stayed thus far, perhaps the worst could be averted. He had found himself thinking of things that might happen next week or next month, as if, after all, there might really be a next week or a next month. And why not? Examining conscience, he found that he had not altogether abandoned the virtue of hope. A monk returned from an errand in the city that afternoon and reported that a camp of refugees was being set up at the park 2 miles down the highway.
"I think it's being sponsored by Green Star, Domne," he added.
"Good," the abbot said. "We're overflowing here, and I've had to turn 3 truckloads of them away." The refugees were noisy in the courtyard, and the noise jangled overwrought nerves. The perpetual quiet of the old abbey was shattered by strange sounds. The boisterous laughter of men telling jokes, the cry of a child, the rattle of pots and pans, hysterical sobbing, a Green Star medic shouting, "Hey, Raff, go fetch an enema hose!" Several times the abbot suppressed an urge to go to the window and call to them for silence. After bearing it as long as he could, he picked up a pair of binoculars, an old book, and a rosary, and went up to one of the old watchtowers, where a thick stone wall cut off most of the sounds from the courtyard. The book was a slim volume of verse, really anonymous, but by legend ascribed to a mythical saint, whose canonization was accomplished only in fable and the folklore of the plains, and not by any act of the Holy See. No one, indeed, had ever found evidence that such a person as Saint Poet of the Miraculous Eyeball had ever lived. The fable had probably arisen out of the story that one of the early Hannigans had been given a glass eyeball by the brilliant physical theorist who was his protege. Zerke could not remember whether the scientist had been Esser Shan or Fardentrot, and who told the prince that it had belonged to a poet who had died for the faith. He had not specified which faith the poet had died for, that of Peter or that of the Texarkanan schismatics, but evidently the Hannigan had valued it, for he had mounted the eyeball in the clutch of a small golden hand, which was still worn upon certain state occasions by princes of the Hark-Hannigan dynasty. It was variously called the Orbis Judicans Conscientias, or the Oculus Poetae Judicis, and the remnants of the Texarkana schism still revered it as a relic. Someone a few years back had proposed the rather silly hypothesis that Saint Poet was the same person as the scurrilous versificator, once mentioned in the journals of the venerable Abbot Jerome. But the only substantiating evidence for this notion was that Fardentrot, or was it Esser Shan, had visited the abbey during the reign of venerable Jerome at about the same date as the scurrilous versificator entry in the journal, and that the gift of the eyeball to Hannigan had occurred at some date after that visit to the abbey. Zerke suspected that the thin book of verse had been penned by one of the secular scientists who had visited the abbey to study the memorabilia at about that time, and that one of them could probably be identified with the scurrilous versificator, and possibly with the Saint Poet of folklore and fable. The anonymous verses were a bit too daring, Zerke thought, to have been written by a monk of the order. The book was a satirical dialogue in verse between 2 agnostics who were attempting to establish by natural reason alone that the existence of God could not be established by natural reason alone. They managed only to demonstrate that the mathematical limit of an infinite sequence of doubting the certainty with which something doubted is known to be unknowable when the something doubted is still a preceding statement of unknowability of something doubted. that the limit of this process at infinity can only be equivalent to a statement of absolute certainty, even though phrased as an infinite series of negations of certainty. The text bore traces of St. Leslie's theological calculus, and even as a poetic dialogue between an agnostic identified only as poet and another only as Thon, it seemed to suggest a proof of the existence of God by an epistemological method. But the versifier had been a satirist. Neither poet nor Don relinquished his agnostic premises after the conclusion of absolute certainty had been reached, but concluded instead that non cogitamus ergo nihil sumus. Abbot Zerke soon tired of trying to decide whether the book was high intellectual comedy or more epigrammatic buffoonery. From the tower, he could see the highway and the city as far as the mesa beyond. He focused the binoculars on the mesa and watched the radar installation for a time, but nothing unusual appeared to be happening there. He lowered the glasses slightly to watch the new Green Star encampment down at the roadside park. The area of the park had been roped off. Tents were being pitched. Utility crews worked at tapping the gas and power lines. Several men were engaged in hoisting a sign at the entrance to the park, but they held it edgewise to his gaze, and he could not read it. Somehow the boiling activity reminded him of a nomad carnival coming to town. There was a big red engine of some sort. It seemed to have a firebox and something like a boiler, but he could not at first guess its purpose. Men in Green Star uniforms were erecting something that looked like a small carousel. At least a dozen trucks were parked on the side road. Some were loaded with lumber, others with tents and collapsible cots. One seemed to be hauling fire bricks, and another was burdened with pottery and straw. Pottery. He studied the last truck's cargo carefully. A slight frown gathered on his forehead. It was a load of urns, or vases, all alike, and packed together with cushioning wads of straw. Somewhere he had seen the like of them, but could not remember where. Still another truck carried nothing but a great stone statue, probably made of reinforced plastic, and a square slab upon which the statue was evidently to be mounted. The statue lay on its back, supported by a wooden framework and a nest of packing material. He could see only its legs and one outstretched hand that thrust up through the packing straw. The statue was longer than the bed of the truck. Its bare feet projected beyond tailgate. Someone had tied a red flag to one of its great toes. Zerke puzzled over it. Why waste a truck on a statue, when there was probable need of another truckload of food? He watched the men who were erecting the sign. At last, one of them lowered his end of the board and climbed a ladder to perform some adjustment of the overhead brackets. With one end resting on the ground, the sign tilted, and Zerke, by craning, managed to read its message. Mercy Camp Number 18, Green Star Disaster Cadre Project. Hurriedly, he looked again at the trucks. The pottery. Recognition came to him. Once he had driven past a crematorium and seen men unloading the same sort of urns from a truck with the same company markings. He swung the binoculars again, searching for the truck loaded with fire bricks. The truck had moved. At last he located it, now parked inside the area. The bricks were being unloaded near the great red engine. He inspected the engine again. What had at first glance appeared to be a boiler now suggested an oven or a furnace. Evenit diabolus, the abbot growled, and started for the wall stairs. He found Dr. Kors in the mobile unit in the courtyard. The doctor was wiring a yellow ticket to the lapel of an old man's jacket, while telling him that he should go to a rest camp for a while and mind the nurses, but that he'd be all right if he took care of himself. Zerke stood with folded arms, munching at the edge of his lips and coldly watching the physician. When the old man was gone, Kors looked up warily. Yes? His eyes took note of the binoculars and re-examined Zerke's face. Oh, he grunted. Well, I have nothing to do with that end of it, nothing at all. The abbot gazed at him for a few seconds, then turned and stalked out. He went to his office and had Brother Patrick call the highest Green Star official. I want it moved out of our vicinity. I'm afraid the answer is emphatically no. Brother Pat, call the workshop and get Brother Lufter up here. He's not there, Domine. Then have them send me a carpenter and a painter. Anybody will do. Minutes later, two monks arrived. I want 5 lightweight signs made at once, he told them. I want them with good long handles. They're to be big enough to be read from a block away, but light enough for a man to carry for several hours without getting dog-tired. Can you do that?
Surely, my lord, what do you want them to say?
Abbot Zerke wrote it for them. Make it big and make it bright, he told them. Make it scream at the eye, that's all. When they were gone, he called Brother Patrick again. Brother Pat, go find me 5 good young healthy novices, preferably with martyr complexes. Tell them they may get what St. Stephen got.
And I may get even worse, he thought, when New Rome hears about it.
Chapter 28 Compline had been sung, but the abbot stayed on in the church, kneeling alone in the gloom of evening.
Domine, mundorum omnium factor, parsuros esto imprimis seis filiis aviantibus ad sideria celi quorum victus difficilior.
He prayed for Brother Joshua's group, for the men who had gone to take a starship and climb the heavens into a vaster uncertainty than any uncertainty faced by man on earth. They'd want much praying for. None was more susceptible than the wanderer to the ills that afflict the spirit, to torture faith and nag a belief, harrowing the mind with doubts. At home, on earth, conscience had its overseers and its exterior taskmasters. But abroad, the conscience was alone, torn between lord and foe. Let them be incorruptible, he prayed. Let them hold true to the way of the order.
Dr. Kors found him in the church at midnight and beckoned him quietly outside. The physician looked haggard and wholly unnerved.
I just broke my promise, he stated challengingly.
The abbot was silent.
Proud of it? He asked at last.
Not especially.
They walked toward the mobile unit and stopped in the bath of bluish light that spilled out its entrance. The medic's lab jacket was soaked with sweat, and he dried his forehead on his sleeve. Zerke watched him with that pity one might feel for the lost.
"We'll leave at once," said Kors. "I thought I'd tell you."
He turned to enter the mobile unit.
"Wait a minute," the priest said. "You'll tell me the rest."
"Will I?"
The challenging tone once again.
"Why? So you can go threaten hellfire? She's sick enough now, and so's the child. I'll tell you nothing."
"You already have. I know who you mean. The child, too, I suppose."
Kors hesitated.
"Radiation sickness. Flash burns. The woman has a broken hip. The father's dead. The fillings in the woman's teeth are radioactive. The child almost glows in the dark.
Vomiting shortly after the blast. Nausea, anemia, rotten follicles. Blind in one eye. The child cries constantly because of the burns. How they survive the shockwave is hard to understand. I can't do anything for them except the Ukrem team. I've seen them."
"Then you know why I broke the promise. I have to live with myself afterwards, man. I don't want to live as the torturer of that woman and that child."
"Pleasanter to live as their murderer instead?"
"You're beyond reasonable argument."
"What did you tell her?"
"If you love your child, spare her the agony. Go to sleep mercifully as quick as you can."
"That's all. We'll leave immediately. We've finished with the radiation cases and the worst of the others. It won't hurt the rest of them to walk a couple of miles. There aren't any more critical dosage cases."
Zerke stalked away, then stopped and called back.
"Finish," he croaked. "Finish and then get out. If I see you again, I'm afraid of what I'll do."
Kors spat.
"I don't like being here any better than you like having me. We'll go now, thanks."
He found the woman lying on a cot with the child in the corridor of the overcrowded guest house. They huddled together under a blanket and both were crying. The building smelled of death and antiseptic. She looked up at his vague silhouette against the light.
"Father?"
Her voice was frightened.
"Yes."
"We're done for, see? See what they gave me?"
He could see nothing, but he heard her fingers pick at the edge of paper, the red ticket. He could find no voice to speak to her. He came to stand over the cot. He fished in his pocket and brought out a rosary. She heard the rattle of the beads and groped for it.
"You know what it is?"
"Certainly, Father."
"Then keep it. Use it."
"Thank you."
"Bear it and pray."
"I know what I have to do."
"Don't be an accomplice. For the love of God, child, don't—"
"The doctor said—"
She broke off. He waited for her to finish. She kept silent.
"Don't be an accomplice."
She still said nothing. He blessed them and left as quickly as possible.
The woman had handled the beads with fingers that knew them. There was nothing he could say to her that she didn't already know. The Conference of Foreign Ministers on Guam has just ended. No joint policy statement has yet been issued. The ministers are returning to their capitals. The importance of this conference, and the suspense with which the world awaits the results, cause this commentator to believe that the conference is not yet ended, but only recessed, so that the foreign ministers may confer with their governments for a few days. An earlier report, which alleged that the conference was breaking up amid bitter invective, has been denied by the ministries. First Minister Recole had only one statement for the press. "I'm going back to talk to the Regency Council, but the weather's been pleasant here. I may come back later to fish." The 10-day waiting period ends today, but it is generally held that the ceasefire agreement will continue to be observed. Mutual annihilation is the alternative. Two cities have died, but it is to be remembered that neither side answered with a saturation attack. The Asian rulers contend that an eye was taken for an eye. Our government insists that the explosion in Itaewon was not an Atlantic missile. But for the most part, there is a weird and brooding silence from both capitals. There has been little waving of the bloody shirt, few cries for wholesale vengeance. A kind of dumb fury, because murder has been done, because lunacy reigns, prevails. But neither side wants total war. Defense remains at battle alert. The General Staff has issued an announcement, almost an appeal, to the effect that we will not use the worst if Asia likewise refrains. But the announcement says further, "If they use dirty fallout, we shall reply in kind, and in such force that no creature will live in Asia for 1,000 years. Strangely, the least hopeful note of all comes not from Guam, but from the Vatican at New Rome. After the Guam conference ended, it was reported that Pope Gregory ceased to pray for peace in the world. Two special masses were sung in the basilica, the Exsurge Quare Obdormis, Mass Against the Heathen, and the Reminiscere, Mass in Time of War. Then the report says His Holiness retired to the mountains to meditate and pray for justice. And now a word from..." "Turn it off," Zerke groaned. The young priest who was with him snapped off the set and stared wide-eyed at the abbot. "I don't believe it." "What, about the Pope?" "I didn't either, but I heard it earlier and New Rome has had time to deny it. They haven't said a word." "What does it mean?" "Isn't that obvious? The Vatican Diplomatic Service is on the job. Evidently, they sent in a report on the Guam conference. Evidently, it horrified the Holy Father." "What a warning, what a gesture." "It was more than a gesture, Father. His Holiness isn't chanting battle masses for dramatic effect. Besides, most people will think he means against the heathen on the other side of the ocean, and justice for our side." This book is continued on Cassette 8, Side 1.